Good morning. This is Darrell Gontry, your host for Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM. And I'm so happy to have on our program today, just hot off the press, Universities on Fire author, Mr. Brian Alexander. And he promised he was going to give us our heavy metal voice. You got to, you know, since you said it, Brian, you got to do it, you know. So.
Well, normally I talk like this, but I can totally do this if you want me to. Yeah.
Cool. So, Brian, before we jump into Universities on Fire, higher education in the climate crisis, share with our audience a little bit about your education background.
Sure. Right now, I'm a senior scholar at Georgetown University, where I teach some classes in their graduate learning, design, and technology program. I'm a full-time education futurist. I work on the future of education. So that means I write books, I make digital media, I write articles, I give talks, I lead workshops with people interested in this. So it's a lot of people in colleges and universities, along with publishers and nonprofits, some governments. I work around the world, every continent except Antarctica so far. My own background is a recovering English professor, a PhD from the University of Michigan back in the 1990s.
Wow, nice. You know, our history goes back to a conference for the professional scholarly publishers that was in D.C.
Yeah.
You were on a panel, and unfortunately, you had fractured your ankle or your leg, and you couldn't travel. And I said to the organizers, this is 2012. I said, hey, or 2013. I said, listen, we can get him up on Skype. And people were like, wow, that's so cool. So we were ahead of the time back then.
Yes, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Thank you for remembering that.
Absolutely. That was a classic moment because I had to fight the powers that be that this would work. And the technology worked beautifully. And the feedback from it working was great, but the feedback about what you were sharing with the audience was even superior to that. So let's talk about Universities on Fire. What motivated you to tackle this topic with this book?
Well, I focus on the future of higher education, and my previous book, Academia Next, took a look at American higher education for the next 25 or 30 years. And that came out, it did well, got an award, all kinds of good stuff. But I wanted to figure out what to do next. And I thought, all right, let's look at the rest of higher education. Let's look at the whole world. And let's look further out. Let's look out to the year 2100. And as I was researching this, not only did I say, wow, this is a huge topic, but also I started finding that climate change was not appearing in most discussions. It wasn't appearing in scholarly journals. When people were talking about higher education, it wasn't appearing in conferences. And the deeper I looked into it, at the same time, in the futurist field, we more or less came to a consensus that you have to take into account climate change for any forecast, for just about any topic. If you're doing the future of a business, the future of journalism, the future of war, of governments, of sex, you got to take into account the many impacts of global warming. So I realized I had an opportunity here, but also that it was something that academics need to take into account as they plan what's going to happen with their academic disciplines and their physical campuses and so on. So the more I dove into this, the deeper it got. I realized this couldn't be an article. This would have to be a book. And now, you know, having finished the book, I've already taken extensive notes for version 2.0 because the field just keeps growing. It keeps developing very, very quickly. And as I walk around or travel around to talk to different academics, there are so many more questions and so many more topics that this is a really, really huge, huge and important problem. I'll be happy to break it down and talk about it. But this,
yes, please,
this,
please do. Please do. Yeah.
Actually, well, if you think about it, I mean, higher education is a complex beast. It's a subculture. It's an industry. It's a sector. That's also in the person of colleges and universities, basically a bunch of small towns or small cities. And so when it intersects climate change, it does so on multiple levels. So one level is the physical campus. So behind you, I can see some great bookshelves and I can imagine an academic building there. Mm-hmm. And you have to think, for example, about the academic buildings. Are they carbon positive? That is, do they emit carbon in the course of their lifespan? Most do. So how do you renovate a building, or how do you build new buildings to make them carbon negative or carbon neutral? What do you do, for example, with the transportation on campus, your physical vehicles? Do you turn them over into electrical vehicles? What about the people who visit? Do you try to encourage them to arrive in electrically powered vehicles? Your own power supply, do you try to switch that to a source that is renewable, such as water or wind or hydro? What do you do with the food service that you offer? I mean, a lot of food, especially in the United States, relies heavily on animals and plant product, animals and animal products, and also involves a lot of travel. So there's a lot of CO2 plus methane generated. Do we start switching our cafeterias and our food service to plant-based food and so on? I mean, the whole physical campus is just one. And that's not even, I'm talking about this in a kind of benevolent way. We also think that we have so many campuses around the world that are subjected to climate forces. About one third of humanity lives within a striking distance of sea lines. So we have to think about how many campuses have to deal with rising tides, with flood surges. And we have campuses that are near arid or in arid or desert areas. So they have to worry about being dried out. And then there are campuses in places like the American Southeast, where the wet bulb temperature, the combination of temperature and humidity, just becomes too hot to not have a health effect on people or to kill people. So, you know, when do we start revising our campuses to protect them, or do we move them? I mean, so that's just one area, you know, just one chapter. I mean, you and I met in the scholarly research world. So you think about how this impacts the whole research enterprise. And that was actually bigger and deeper than I thought, because it turns out that just about every science is involved. You know, chemistry, physics, hydrology, meteorology, obviously environmental studies and earth science. Mm-hmm. But right now we're seeing just about every other academic discipline getting involved. Religious scholars are trying to figure out what happens when religious faith leaders or members change their beliefs about climate, looking at new religious movements. Philosophers are looking at the ethics of climate change. Mm-hmm. And even the humanities, we're seeing historians rethinking the role of climate change. We're seeing people in communication, the arts, and in literature thinking about how do you communicate this problem and so on. But trying to do all this research, and this research is so important. I mean, this helps shape what we know as a species about climate change. But how do you support this, and how do you expand it? How do you develop faculty? And then most of it's interdisciplinary. I mean, where are you today, Darrell? Are you in New Jersey?
I'm in Pennsylvania, outside. I used to be in New Jersey, and we moved to right outside of Philadelphia in Whitpain.
Yeah. Okay.
And we have... And interesting enough, I am on a nonprofit board called Wissahickon Trails, and it's all about, managing water and the environment.
Yeah.
We have 9 trails, and there's water that's flowing through and everything. Yeah.
And that can be a wonderful attraction for hikers, and at the same time, it can be destructive of the trails.
Yes.
So if we're going to take a look at just those trails alone and the area around them and trying to see how climate change will impact them, you're going to have to take a look at, immediately geography and geology, mm-hmm. Not to mention hydrology and weather, meteorology, but also you probably want to bring in local history and sociology. I mean, the topic becomes interdisciplinary. In fact, the slogan I've been running with is climate change is the new liberal arts.
I love that.
And that brings thanks. And that brings us to another chapter, another topic, which is what happens to teaching and learning. So mm-hmm. if all faculty are doing more and more research into this, then this should play out in terms of what they teach as well. Not to mention, I mean, all the polling that I've seen shows that traditional age students are way more interested in climate than their elders are. So is this something that academics should offer more classes in? So mm-hmm. should we expect to see more classwork, more minors, more major certificate programs, graduate degrees, maybe entire colleges? And then there's a question of how do you teach this stuff? I mean, should we teach more with simulations, more project-based learning, more inquiry-based learning? Should we use, how do we help students who've gone through some form of climate trauma? They've gone through a terrible storm or seen a city knocked out.
Just at Seton Hall just last semester, I'm an adjunct professor there. I teach professional sales. Yeah. And there was flooding in New Jersey. And one of our students in Paterson, New Jersey was stuck in her car. And unfortunately, she and her person riding with her drowned.
Oh, my gosh.
And the professor didn't release them from class. The question is, professor had said, okay, it heavy rains, I'm a canceled class, maybe she might be alive today. So
oh no Oh no. Oh, that's terrible. Oh my gosh. So we're going to face more and more of that the rest of our lives, the rest of the century. So how many campuses are going to have to think about, I mean, on the practical basis, when do you switch that class online, right? I was talking with somebody at California State University system. They're describing how they had terrible floods. They overtopped levees, which is not a good sign, right? And so they had to switch classes online just so that people could make it. But then, so that student, that poor student, her classmates, what's the psychological toll on them? How does the campus support them? How does Seton Hall, keep them going? And that prof, I mean, how can the campus support that prof in dealing with the grief and guilt of that decision? So we're gonna have to be thinking about this. But your example is a good one, I'm afraid, for another reason, which is that I've been talking about the in academia as a kind of insulated creature, but we also exist in the world. We have close relationships with our immediate community, and then that climate change hits that. I mean, how do you, for example, can a campus partner with a community to do climate mitigation? So in the case of getting too many floods, right? Does the campus help with, say, building up walls or elevating thing or putting in new wetlands? And does that involve partnerships with, say, academic researchers in that field, like civil engineering, or does it involve students who work from service learning or professional learning? And then beyond that, I mean, thinking about the conversation you and I are having right now, which is, in the ether, it's online, so it's available for anybody in the world. How does an institution like Seton Hall or the other 20,000 colleges and universities, how do they give platforms to their faculty, staff, and students to take this kind of knowledge out to the whole world? I mean, that's arguably in the largest scale. If humanity is facing the greatest crisis of our century right now, I mean, something that's like the scale of the Industrial Revolution plus World War II combined, what role does higher ed have in that? I mean, should we intervene in the struggle? Should we try to help governments? Should we try to lobby nonprofits and businesses? Should we try to help save civilization and help shape the one to come, in the wake of this? That's one of the great questions I want to ask academics. What is our role in this? Do we sit it out in an ivory tower, or do we actually engage? So when I say the climate crisis hits higher ed in multiple ways, that's the last way, the biggest way. But it's a really multi-level problem.
You can look at any of the disaster movies that have been released over the last 20 years. They always call when it hits the fan, they call in the academics to explain what's going on. So
Right.
the question is, can the academics get ahead of that, so that the legislators who have the purse strings are aware of what's happening and what are the consequences of not doing anything?
Well, that's a great trope. I've seen that trope so many times. You made me think of the War of the Worlds from the late 1950s with George Pal doing the special effects. And they've got a great scientist engineer who basically saves the human race, right? Well, how do we get out in front? I mean, some are already doing this. So, the Extinction Rebellion movement, there's actually a scientist rebellion, and these guys are doing things like trying to block access to buildings or sitting down in traffic. Some of them last week were trying to interfere with the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Some of these people are taking very traditional public intellectual roles. They're lecturing Congress, they're appearing in media, they're writing scholarly books or popular books, which is all great. What else can they do? There are all kinds of possibilities, and then those possibilities then redound back on us. Because what happens if you've got a wonderful professor who's doing all this lecturing, but then we notice that their campus is still emitting tons of CO2? It's getting it's electricity from carbon, from coal, let's say. They're serving steak with every dinner. They've got gas guzzling trucks driving around campus. When does then that become a hypocritical problem? And what about, I go back to those students. I think Greta Thunberg is about 20 or 21. She's college age, right? The students in Europe, from Just Stop Oil, who are throwing food at classic works of art. I think that was a mistake. But my point is, there a lot of them were college students or university students. What are these students going to do on our campuses? Are they going to be patient while we take 10 years to slowly think and revise about the preparatory planning towards another plan? Or are they going to go on strike? This past fall in Barcelona, a group of students struck the University of Barcelona to compel the university to require all students to take classes in climate change, graduate students and undergrads. And they won. And the university now requires that. That's a very basic act. What happens when you've got Seton Hall, right? Hypothetically, what happens when a student goes down to Patterson or goes to New York City and is part of a strike and gets arrested? What happens if a faculty member writes a furious editorial and it goes viral and they get doxxed? How does the university support these people? Do they decide to support them? We're potentially entering a period of widespread civil unrest as a result of the climate crisis. How does the college administration act? How do the individual academics on campus, the librarians, the technologists, the professors, how do they respond? That's the kind of thing we've got to be anticipating and acting on now.
I know you have your book tour. Are you finding that universities are open to have you come in to lecture about your book in this topic?
Yes, but there's very little traction that I'm seeing. I'm seeing that the traditional age students, the teenagers up to, people 22, they love this. This is part of their world. Unlike you and I, they grew up immersed in this. The science is not endowed for them. And they see the world on fire and they really, really want to act. And they're very engaged. I find a lot of faculty and staff are much less so. They don't disagree that this is an issue, but they often feel that they have no traction. They see that they can't do much about it in their role. They say, "Well, I'm just an anthropologist. What can I do? I'll get a Prius eventually, or I'll shop using cloth bags instead of plastic bags. What else can I do?" Thinking about how to change academia is in many ways new. But the second problem is that this is politically dicey. And that's really an issue for presidents and boards. This is a very controversial issue, and there are a lot of risks in taking a stand. So if a campus decides to, I was talking to the president of one university they were thinking about resourcing their electrical power. They bought it all from a utility in the town where they lived. But the problem was the utility was actually a local family business. I figured it was natural gas or if it was oil, but switching off from them would be a blow to them and would be a real, bad mark for them in the community. So the president has to think, oh gosh, is this worth it, right? And I also think so many staff, so many faculty are just exhausted from the past, 7 years. They've lived through a planetary pandemic of historical proportions. They've been whipsawed by economic chaos. To different extents, different people have been suffering for politics, depending on their ideology and where they are. And we've done this when academia in the United States has been shrinking, enrollment's been dropping. A lot of these people are burned out or afraid. And if I show up and say, hey, by the way, here's global catastrophe I want you to spend some extra time with, they can just say, I can't. I can't right now, but we have to. That's my ultimate message, is that this is something which is not going to go away. Nature isn't just going to change its mind because we're exhausted. Nature bats last, as they say.
What do you think are the important, simple beginning steps for us to begin to address the climate issue within the university system?
I think on the campus leadership level, this has to take the form of strategic planning and it has to take the form of doing that right now. So thinking about your campus moving forward, does it have to move? If you're, for example, on the East Coast of the U.S., how much longer can you stay there? There are campuses that are on coastlines, right, that are on the beach. And that's an issue. And there are a lot of people on beaches, as I mentioned before. But also, even if you're 10 miles in, as the sea level rises, the salt water begins to infiltrate the water table, and that's going to do terrible things to the plants and animals around you and so on. Not to mention, if the sea level rise nibbles away your coastline, it also nibbles away your local economy. So you may want to start thinking about, do you want to move, or do you want to invest either on your own or partnership with localities with some form of defense? And the same goes if you're in the American Southwest dealing with aridification, or the American Southeast dealing with heat.
Sure.
I mean, that's on the strategic planning level. But then for everybody in the immediate operational level, everyone from the registrar and accounts management to the history faculty to the chief technology officer, we have to start planning and acting right now on what this means for you. And this, again, it cuts across multiple levels. So what does it mean in your office? Do you, I mean, some of these are simple, right? Do you recycle? Not all of academia does. Do you have, light systems that power down enough? Do you crank up the air conditioning too high? The buildings that you're in right now, how you renovate them. Should you, do this with an eye towards, carbon neutrality or carbon being carbon negative? Mm-hmm. Think about, I think, the most controversial part of this for academia, which is flying less. Mm-hmm. I mean, the physics is pretty clear. Aircraft, they just offer tremendous amounts of CO2. And right now, we don't have a good replacement. It's different from cars, right? Where you can get an electrical car right now. That's no problem. It's a little more expensive, but that's a different problem. But with aircraft, there's a lot of furious research going into this, but we don't have a replacement. Right. Going by a blimp or a Zeppelin would be great. We know how to do that, but we don't have it set up commercially yet. Mm-hmm. We can go by train, but in the US, our train service is really spotty. But also, there's a lot of resistance to not flying, because flying is it's an academic perk, and it's a way to reconnect with a beloved community, professionals. Can we also think about, for example, changing up our food service? That's on a material level. That's not that hard. It's not as hard as inventing a new aircraft. Mm-hmm. But culturally, personally, we have so many cultures that are invested in this. How do you? That's a tricky one to do. And then to think about your curriculum. I mean, both teaching more about this, but also supporting teaching more. If you're a photographer and you teach photography and you're really keen on this subject, but you haven't studied it, how can your university or college support you so that you can include this in your photographic classwork? And the same goes for research, research librarians, and reference librarians, how can they help faculty and staff do more and more with this? Mm-hmm. Thinking about this in terms of collection development, and then thinking in the library field, how this impacts information literacy.
I'm in the Thielman School of Business teaching professional sales. And one of the presentations I do for my students is called Demonstrating Expertise. And that is having an understanding of the macro and micro economics and government and industry and all of that. And one factor that I see that's affecting every bit of business is climate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So business and economics as academic fields, I mean, this is all over the place. I mean, I'm seeing, I'm blanking on his name. There was an economist who got the Nobel Prize in economics for a forecasting model which was aimed at climate change to figure out how much we discount our descendants over time. I'm just blanking on his name. But I've seen economists and people in business looking at things like what kind of financial structures should we build in order to, for example, deal with the huge colonial era imbalances between the global north and the global south, the developed world and the developing world. What does this do to different parts of business? So I just mentioned a few business opportunities, right? Setting up a blimp service across the West Coast or the East Coast. That'd be fascinating. How can you model this out? Is this viable? Marketing, thinking about what gets to go in marketing content. I mean, can you make green or climate stuff appealing and make it successful? But then you think about some of the physical parts of marketing. Should you cut back packaging? Because packaging is in many ways just a waste of carbon. Can you do that and make it look successful, like Amazon has done with its very simple boxes? Thinking as well about microeconomic thing. One of the huge demands I've heard from businesses for college students is to give is to produce college students who can advise them on how to make this transition. I've heard this from big companies like Amazon, and they say, yeah, we need to know how we should change up our electrical systems, how we should change our hiring practices, you know, our HR systems, how we should change procurement and all of this. We need someone who can help us with this. I think that in many ways, business is a great field for watching all of this happen. And this plays out all the different subfields in micro and macroeconomics. This plays out in marketing and finance. I mean, this is, I think business people are going to be ahead of a lot of others pretty soon.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I just finished a certificate program with Wharton Executive Program on corporate governance. And board of directors, everyone's talking about ESG, you know, and there was a gentleman I had on my program a couple of weeks ago from Merrill Lynch. He's been focusing on ESG companies for the last 10 years as part of his portfolio.
So we have to think about this. I mean, we know that ESG, there's a kind of consensus this is a good thing to do. It's a nice way that it brings together climate justice in a really clear way, which we absolutely need to have. And yet it's controversial politically, you know, and people will attack it in different ways, and sometimes surprising ways. I've seen objections from within college trustees and university boards, sometimes because the people there simply work in oil and gas. Right. And they just object to this completely. Others who will, and we saw this over the past year as a group of alumni, faculty, and staff try to get Harvard to divest from fossil fuels, and they still haven't. And they said, look, we have a fiduciary duty to our university, and these stocks are great. They pay off a lot of money. Sure, they're bad for the planet, but we need to keep doing them. I mean, this is what I mean by kind of civil unrest on campus. But also that's, you know, it's hard if you're a university leader, and it's hard to have that kind of struggle. And of course, then there's just, you know, ideological opposition from, say, you know, Trump or DeSantis. And then just the education necessary to make ESG palatable, to make sure that people understand what they're getting into with that. I mean, again, I keep thinking that we're just in the middle of this huge civilizational transformation.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And that's never easy. And there's a lot of work to be done. And I think this is where academia needs to change itself, but also where academia can play such a positive historical role in helping the whole species make the transformation.
So believe it or not, Brian, we just have a couple of minutes left. What last words would you like to leave with our audience about universities on fire, higher education in the climate crisis?
I'd say check it out. Check out the website for it, universitiesonfire.com, or just grab a copy of the book and start thinking about what this means. If you're in or adjacent to academia, if you're the parent of an undergrad, if your spouse is a grad student, if you're a professor, staff, if you're working in a local or state or federal government and you have, you know, higher education as part of your portfolio, if you're thinking about this in any way, or if you're outside of academia completely and you're wondering, why on earth should this matter? Why are we talking about this sector? I hope the book can answer some questions, but also can give you some more questions to ask, because this is just the opening move. We're just wading into the storm right now. It's going to get a lot deeper and a lot hairier. And we can only do this if we all act, think, and talk together right now to get ahead of it.
Wow, beautiful. Ladies and gentlemen, we are here with Mr. Brian Alexander, PhD, author and university professor at Georgetown, with his new book, Universities on Fire, Higher Education in the Climate Crisis. Brian, I want to thank you for coming on the program. As always, you've always given us great information. Thank you.
Darrell, thank you for the opportunity. It's a real pleasure agreeing to reconnect with you, and thank you for being such a gracious host.
Oh, you're very welcome, sir. That wraps it up this week on Leadership with Darrell Gunter on WSOU 89.5 FM and streaming on the net at wsou.net. But remember, leadership begins with you. Have a great day.